Welcome to the UUMA podcast channel. What follows is a rebroadcast of the 2017 Berry Street essay, originally posted as a video recording to www.uuma.org in the summer of 2017. Over the coming year, we'll be posting archived Berry Street essays as podcasts. Visit the UUMA website to watch this and other Berry Street essays.
Good afternoon. Oh, gathered members of the Ministerial Conference in Berry Street. I'm Kate Walker, your humble scribe. My duties as scribe require I convene the Executive Committee of the Ministerial Conference in Berry Street, which in turn is charged with nominating the essayist. The executive committee is currently composed of Barbara Queeman, Mark Morrison Reed, and Mitra Ranema. The members of the conference are you. Due to your presence today, you showed up. I now declare the 197th Ministerial Conference in Berry Street in session. We begin today by diverting from the norm. Our selected essayist for 2017 was Sophia Betancourt, who accepted the invitation with due reverence, respect, and probably with a little trepidation. However, she was subsequently called to another duty as interim co-president of the UUA. Seeing as her energy and attention were focused elsewhere, she did indeed withdraw as the 2017 essayist. The executive committee and I soon pulled together a panel of five trusted colleagues who, despite 2 months' notice, all graciously agreed to serve. They will be introduced shortly. Our normal pattern is not to give any subject parameters to the essayist. However, given the circumstances of not having 15 months to anxiously or calmly ponder their topic, the executive committee wanted to avoid having five disparate reflections with no connective tissue. So we gave the panel the following broad questions. What does it mean for religious leaders to speak truth to power? What would it look like to authentically move that which has been marginalized closer and closer toward the center? Or what does centering that which is marginalized look like? We also gave them the freedom to interpret these questions as broadly as they deem necessary in order to bring their best wisdom to this body. We set the program to allow each speaker to have 10 minutes to respond, and then followed by 15 minutes of moderated questions among the panelists. The floor will not be opened for questions. Also normative to our conference proceedings is for me to request a nomination from the floor for a moderator. We're not going to do that this year either. We needed a moderator early to help gather our panel in their deliberations over the past 2 months. We were very pleased that Leslie Takahashi agreed to be our moderator. And given the turmoil of our professional association and sensitivity of the topic, I'd like to point out the presence of our beloved chaplains. Thank you. I've asked them to be available down at the front of the stage area following the conference. Today, you are all witnesses to an unprecedented conference in form and function, as well as content. You are present for the first conference that is focusing on the issues of power, marginalization, racism, and ethnic oppression. In my preparation for my scribal remarks, I looked at the essays to what our colleagues of the past might have had to say on such topics as race, racism, blacks, Negroes, whites, slavery, emancipation, abolition, nationalism, civil war, civil rights, or civil voting acts. At first, I started with just the civil rights era. Then I expanded to the Civil War, and then I returned to the Black Affairs Council, BAC, and the Black and White Action Group, BAWA, in the late 1960s, and the split in the UUA. I found almost nothing. I then expanded my research to all the essays that we have on record. We do not have all of them. But those that we have, I found 11 essays referenced one of those areas as a concern to their primary topic. In this small window, I found inconsistent and parts of our history and obvious gaps. For example, and working backward in time, during the BAC-BAWA split, little was said about civil rights. However, in 1970, Frank Gentile referenced the BAC-BAWA vote as an example of misdirected intent. He said, "I voted yes on the BAC and no on BAWA and the Chicanos." Quote, "The BAC vote was wrong, because the appropriate function of a religious society is not that of a social work agency, political party, labor union, or united community chest. Its proper function is the worship of God," end quote. In 1968, Frank Holmes lamented how racism is a recurring reminder of aggressiveness, yet he failed to write about Martin Luther King's assassination 1 month prior. In May of 1865, Henry Whitney Bellows wrote on the need to stand together in association, but there was no mention of slavery, emancipation, or the ending of the Civil War 1 month prior. We can ask ourselves, and we should ask ourselves, what did we make of this rather slim and privileged history? Even if we compensate with our 21st century lens, looking back at this history raises some serious, troubling questions about the Berry Street essay and conference itself. Perhaps it is yet another white wake-up call, inviting us to re-examine our claims of being a progressive liberal religious movement. Certainly, a deeper analysis is required. I have begun working on the 200th anniversary of The Essayist and asking, what were we talking about the last 200 years? Here ends my scribal remarks. It is customary for the outgoing member of the executive committee to offer the prayer. However, that person, Barbara Queeman, could not be with us today, nor could Mark Morrison Reed, who is next in line. So I'm delighted to invite Meet Geronima to offer this year's prayer.
Thank you. So let us first prepare to pray, and then we can pray to prepare for the 2017 Berry Street panel. We begin with the kindling of our mighty Unitarian Universalist chalice. The great Persian poet Jalil ad-Din Muhammad Rumi wrote, "Let the beauty you love be what you do. There are 1,000 ways to kneel and kiss the ground." 800 years later, the feminist Margaret L. Mitchell wrote, Sometimes, when it's all finally too much, I climb into my car, roll up the windows, and somewhere between backing out the driveway and rounding the first corner, I let out a yell that could topple Manhattan. How do you pray? What is the sound or movement of your prayer? Is it a shout, an amen, a kiss, a please? Oh God, thank you, a blessing, an inhale, an exhale, as we prepare to pray. Let us all share one movement or sound of your prayer together. Amen. We gather in a climate of heightened awareness of our country, our leadership, injustice, and oppression. We gather in heightened awareness of our faith, institution, our commitment, our colleagues, structures, our future. In this climate of heightened awareness, it's time for a collective prayer to be heightened. Breathe. Spirit of life, in these painful and confusing times, first we say thank you, humbly, thank you, painfully, thank you. We call on all that is sacred to be with us now. We call upon the great sacred universe whose existence makes us stronger and softer. We call on the sacred energy of life, of humanity, from which we are nourished and to which we return nourishment. We call on the sacred, fierce, breathtaking, agonizing, just love that calls us to act. We call on the sacred and layered inner consciousness of each and all. We call upon all that is sacred to be present because we need more than ourselves alone. In these times, we even need more than one another. We need the sacred nuances of lives exchanging breath every second, every day. We humbly open our hearts to the existence of the sacred so our mind and body and spirit may be prepared to receive connection. Connection to the great arc that we cannot calculate or divine by conscience, but we are told bends towards justice. Connection to the living tradition of Unitarian Universalism that can save lives. And connection to our blessed panel of colleagues. May they all be received and held in a heightened love and dignity. Sacred Spirit of Life, we call on you to be with us now and prepare us so that when minds and hearts are shared, we can each believe in the all. Thank you, thank you, thank you. May it be so, and amen.
Let us begin. I invite Leslie Takahashi to begin her role as moderator.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Mitra. It is a great honor to be here in the role of moderator for this particular panel. It is a great honor to be here because of the long tradition that it represents in our tradition, in our faith tradition. And it is also a great honor because of the particular form of this panel. In what in our congregation we now refer to as the year that will not behave itself. Just saying. Before you, you have five people who will speak as essayists And for all of us who speak for a living, we all know that it is much harder to speak in 10 minutes and give truth than it is sometimes to speak in 20. So I want to honor them for the great work that they have done in such a short amount of time. We are going to ask you, as you hear the truths that they provide, to do so in a spirit of openness and willingness, to try on ideas that may not be ones that you ultimately come to keep within your store of truths, but to be willing to consider them in this space we are creating together. We will also be, I'm going to be introducing them, and I want to say that we have invited, I'm going to be introducing them in the order in which they're going to be speaking, and we have invited Ashley Horan to speak first, so that she may offer a special invitation to those who are identify as white among us to engagement and open-heartedness. Reverend Ashley Horan is a lifelong Unitarian Universalist and the executive director of Moose Jaw, the Minnesota Unitarian Universalist Social Justice Alliance. I'll ask you to hold your applause till we have all the panelists, because we're on a tight time frame. The Reverend Dr. Christian Harper has been the minister of the Unitarian Church of Barnstable since 2002. Reverend Adam Robersmith is a parish minister and spiritual director serving Second Unitarian Church in Chicago now and serving the Universalist Church of West Hartford beginning this fall. Reverend Mel Hoover is co-minister emeriti with his wife, Reverend Rose Eddington, of the UU Congregation of Charleston, West Virginia, and they are currently co-founders of the Mel Rose Ministry for Transformational Change. The Reverend Marta I. Valentin is in a shared ministry with the UU Church of Medford, Massachusetts, and has just been appointed denominational counselor to the UU students at Harvard Divinity School. I present to you today our Berry Street essayist. I want to mention to you now that between each, because they will be giving you much to digest in a short form, we will take a minute of silence between each of their presentations, and I ask you to observe that as a respectful moment of silence. Thank you. And with that, I invite our essayist to begin.
Ten Commandments for Relevant Reparative Ministry, a reinterpretation of the Hebrew Scriptures for those of us who are white. Number one, and God spoke, "I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods but me." Or, "The freedom and flourishing of all people is our ultimate concern and our highest loyalty." Our faith's central premise is that we must shape a world that in which every person can fulfill the promise of our inborn capacity for wholeness and love. But such a world, in the words of Langston Hughes, is the land that never has been yet, and yet must be. As we grapple with the white supremacy in our tradition's DNA and the magnitude of injustice in our society, we know it is a leap of faith to commit our lives' work to building such a world with no proof yet of its possibility. And yet, it is the only thing worthy of our ultimate allegiance. Number two, you shall not have graven images, or we shall not worship the structures of our faith over its spirit. Unitarian Universalism is a core set of beliefs and values enshrined in institutions and practices. And it is heartbreakingly clear that our current incarnation prevents us from living out our deepest commitments. When we worry more about the financial risks of making reparations to Black Unitarian Universalists than about the spiritual costs of not making them, when our congregations refrain from taking bold moral stances because our members might quit, when we're more committed to preserving our institutions and our culture than to creating a world in which all of us are free, we commit idolatry. The sin of mistaking that which is finite for that which is ultimate and most worthy. Number three, you shall not take the name of the Lord in vain, or we shall not claim to be allies without being transformed. My friend Caitlin Breedlove regularly poses the clarion question of her former organization, Southerners on New Ground. Are you willing to be transformed in service of the work? Our hearts yearn to say yes, individually and congregationally. And yet it will require us to engage in surrender, a spiritual practice at which most of us white folks are novices. But when we decide that what the world needs us to be is more important than what we are comfortable being, we will exchange our fear and our fragility for the deep sense of belonging and belovedness that comes from collaboratively building a different reality. Number four, you shall honor the Sabbath, or we shall engage in practices that prepare us to show up. Our faith and our world need us white people to bring thick skins, tender hearts, and real skills. We're being asked to take our shifts for the revolution. And the question is whether we're ready to clock in. So I'm going to say that it is time for some intensive spiritual training. What are we doing individually and congregationally that will allow us to hear and believe hard truths from people of color, even when we don't particularly like the tone they're delivered in? How can we become humble and courageous enough to say yes, even when we have no evidence that we will be right or safe? Number five, you shall honor your father and mother, or we shall reclaim our history in its fullness. Whiteness robs white people of our sense of belonging to the arc of history and the web of humanity. When we awaken to the white supremacy culture that has shaped us, our instinct is often to further disassociate ourselves, because owning our lineage also means owning the sins of our forebears. But we must reclaim our ancestors and our history, both that which nurtured death and that which planted seeds of life. Susan B. Anthony's fierce feminism and her intense racism. Our congregation's civil rights work at the same time as we were fleeing, participating in white flight. Our denominational commitments to becoming anti-racist and our defunding of the very work it would take to do that. Our history is not our fault, but it's our responsibility. In accepting this, we will find a sustaining connection to the ancestors who did resist, who struggled, and who passed along the unfinished work of their lives for us to complete. Number six, you shall not kill, or we shall refrain from doing harm, and when we do, we shall make amends. We have a rosy theological anthropology. You might sum it up as, from love we are, and to love we shall return. But our rightful resistance to religion that told people that they were sinful and unloved has left our theology, our rituals, and our leadership ill-equipped to respond effectively to behaviors that are sinful and unloving. We know that intent is less important than impact. It matters more that your foot hurts than that I stepped on it. So our ministry as and with white people, then, is to both do less harm. I'm going to say that again. Let's do less harm. And when we do, let's help our people engage in rituals and processes of confession, atonement, and repair long before we seek absolution. Number 7, you shall not commit adultery, or we shall be faithful to those whose personhood is most consistently dismissed and denied. Liberation theology reminds us of God's preferential option for the poor. Liberation universalism might say, the only hell is here on earth, where we are called to both save and be saved by one another. This theology requires that our deepest loyalty be with those who are farthest from the center of power, most of whom will never be Unitarian Universalists. The dynamics of power mean that we cannot credibly side with both the system of policing and the movement for Black lives. We can't prioritize both including Trump voters and telling our undocumented trans congregant that her life is of supreme worth. We have to choose whose vision we affirm and follow, because a world in which we are all safe and free is better for all of us. Number 8, you shall not steal, or we shall learn to take up less space and hoard fewer resources. The payoff for doing scary things in public is not that we will be seen as special, but as trustworthy. When we show up at the Black Lives Matter vigil or the ICE protest, will we leverage our power and introduce the reporters who want to talk to the yellow shirt people to the black and brown organizers who put the action together? How are our congregations who have committed to sanctuary also giving away money from our endowments, giving meeting space to community organizers, accompanying the undocumented to deportation hearings? Number 9, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, or we shall trust those who have known oppression. Many of us who are white respond to the lived experience of our siblings of color with incredulity and interrogation. But, simply, when those whose humanity is regularly denied tell us that they have been harmed, we must stop, listen, and believe them. When we are decentered or confronted with anger, our discomfort is not equivalent to the trauma of living within a system designed to diminish and destroy our siblings of color. And number 10, you shall not covet, or we shall trust that our needs will be supplied. For those of us who are white, our ministry now is to preach the good news that, yes, everything is falling apart. But as it does, the possibility of transformation is born. We shall not be neutral and non-anxious. Neutrality is a myth, and anxiety is inevitable. Rather, we shall be faithful, trusting that we can harness the courage and clarity we need even while we are anxious. Trust that when we decenter ourselves we do not need to disengage. Trust that we can wield our faith in service of the grand enterprise of collective liberation and universal salvation. Thank you, dear ones, for the privilege of sharing these commandments, which have all been learned from gracious teachers and comrades of color. My prayer is that they help us receive the gift of my co-panelists' wisdom here, and that they help those of us who are white to be worthy of this faith, that our siblings of color, against all odds, are still telling us is worthy of redemption and renewal. May we all be instruments of bringing a faith, a world that has never been yet, into glorious being.
I just want to remind us, we are going to take a moment of silence between each of our sharings, and then at the end, we'll have a chance to express our appreciation.
When I arrived at Meadville Lombard Theological School in the fall of 1995, I was not prepared for the racism that I would experience from my fellow classmates. I was not prepared for the blatant hostility and rage and mistrust of me by a group of people who were training to lead our faith and would soon be colleagues. I was told by people in their third or sixth year journey into Unitarian Universalism that I didn't belong in this faith that had been part of my family for generations. I was called a quota filler, a nigger. I had classmates who would get up and move when I sat down next to them in chapel. I was told it'd be easier if I weren't there. I was maced by a white student who saw me walking behind her as threatening. It is no surprise to me that we have come to this point in our association's history. At the end of my first year, when the students of color attempted to bring in outside help from colleagues, we were told to stop whining. We were pioneers. Sacrifices for the next generation. I don't believe in sacrificial theology, so I almost didn't finish seminary. But with the help of Danielle Glad, one of our amazing Cradle Black UUs, the Reverend Abi and Lalita Janamanchi, and the Reverend Karen Hutt, I did graduate. Others were not so lucky. We have not reached the promised land, but there is hope. I think some of you are seeing some of us for the very first time. We aren't invisible anymore. I'm witnessing some of you listen to the pain and rage and not turn away. You're not saying we are misunderstanding or we're overreacting or even more common, we are lying. At least not most of you. Some of you are beginning to acknowledge our stories as part of the UU narrative. Alice Walker wrote, "We are a people. The people don't throw their geniuses away. If they do, it is our duty as witnesses for the future to collect them again for the sake of our children, if necessary, bone by bone." There are other stories that belong in our narratives. In 1981, the Reverend Dr. Yvonne Sion became the first black woman to receive fellowship and ordination in the Unitarian Universalist Association. When I graduated in 1999, 18 years later, only 7 black women had followed her, myself included. In 2000, there was only 26 black UU ministers. Today, there are over 110 UU ministers of color. Now, I must acknowledge that black women were not the first women of color to be fellowshipped and ordained. The Reverend Deanna Arakawa, the senior minister of the Niantic Community Church, a UCC church in Connecticut, was fellowshipped and ordained in 1978 and 1979. These are stories we should know. We should be able to rattle off their names as easily as we do Olympia Brown and Cecilia Burleigh, as easily as we do Joseph Jordan and Egbert Ethelred Brown, as easily as we do John Murray, Hosea Ballou, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. We owe a debt of gratitude for these ancestors who taught and continue to teach us all about resilience, forgiveness, and the hope for transformation. When I decided to enter the ministry, a well-meaning now colleague said to me, "Our congregations aren't ready for you." I believe he was speaking the truth as he saw it. And what he saw was that at the time, no black woman had ever been called through the regular settlement process to a UU church as senior or sole minister. In 1999, two of us, the Reverend Adele Smith Penniman and myself, entered search and were called to congregations as sole ministers. That was 18 years ago, and since that time, only a little over a dozen women of color and indigenous women ministers have entered search and been called to UU congregations as senior or sole ministers. Twice as many UU women ministers of color have been called to work with our theological schools, our association, as chaplains, executive directors, and in other community ministry settings. And for the past 3 months, the Reverend Sophia Betancourt has served as our first female Unitarian Universalist president. I was speaking with the Reverend Abija Namanchi recently about the irony of where some of us ministers and religious professionals of color stand today. We were once the radical, loud, in-your-face champions for racial justice. We organized and protested and pushed for funding. We spoke truth to power and were stars for the year. Until we were no longer willing to be used or no longer usable. In the end, we did sacrifice our physical and emotional health, our sense of belonging, and in some instances, our faith. And while I do hope that our dedication and love helped move the association a little bit further towards the beloved community, I do not want anyone else to pay the same price we did. And yet I feel out of place in this conversation about white supremacy. It's not that I don't understand what it means in academia, but I also know what it means to my congregation. I know what it means to the outside world. I know what it means to white supremacists, you know, the ones who kill people because of their race, their ability, their religion, their gender identity, their sexual orientation. And I feel afraid that by saying this, I will never belong. Or worse, I will be forced to leave the faith that I have stood by my whole life. I've served 2 churches since receiving fellowship, one for 3 years and one for 15. I've learned some important things about this work. People will not change without relationship building. Calling your colleagues names, yelling at them, belittling them, which some of us have been doing, will not change hearts or create greater understanding. We're letting the fear and frustration and anger of our world work its way through us and create more barriers? How do you center what has been marginalized without marginalizing that which has been centered? That might not be the right question, but I care about that answer. Our faith calls us to be better than what we have been being, to meet people where they are, to walk forward with them and stand present when they step back. After all, aren't we the faith that, as Reverend Dr. Mark Morrison Reed says, will drag the last unrepented sinner kicking and screaming into heaven? The second thing I've learned is that people cannot change without a process of forgiveness. The racism I experience hurts because I care. I care about how I am treated. I care about belonging. I care about you. Our Universalist heritage calls on us to be forgiving and to expand the understanding of God's grace and redemption to everyone. And yet we show each other none. And finally, we will not go forward with only one path. I feel that we're being too dogmatic, too orthodox, too fundamentalist. If you're not using our language, our process, then you are perpetuating white supremacy, or you're suffering from internalized oppression. I believe there are multiple paths to God, to salvation, to wholeness. However, if I am wrong and it takes me longer to get to the promised land, I hope you will be there waiting patiently for me with open arms when I arrive, as I will be for you. Thank you for listening.
I have spent much of my life and all of my ministry thinking about formation. How do we become who we are? How do we become the Unitarian Universalists that we are? How do we form communities and institutions? And how do we make sure that they embody our best ideals and values? And in this, I go back to Emerson and bell hooks and Sharon Welch and Maria Harris and Bill Jones, who remind us that how and what we are taught actually determines who we will become and how we will act. They tell us that formation is a process of development, but is sustained and limited by the ways that we frame our theology, our ethics, our language. And I don't think we spend enough time examining what shapes us, and whether or not it is appropriate to or adequate to the task at hand. If we spent enough time on it, I do not think we would be where we are right now. So, for example, in seminary, it was the exciting thing to ask people whenever they heard someone preface a phrase with the word but to say, and. There was a lot of not either or, but both and, which has now become our common and often unexamined frame. By using that language, we teach ourselves that we can either distinguish between things, or we can theoretically include everything fully, but we can't be inclusive while distinguishing what is important in any given moment. And I think that's a mistake. I want to go beyond both and into a much larger collection of possibilities. I don't just want an agreement of opposites. I want an interconnection of layers and opinions and truths that make room for the changing needs of our people and our world and our faith. So I come to this as a parish minister, a formator, and a spiritual director, as a multiracial person who is often misinterpreted as white, as a queer person who is often misinterpreted as a gay man, even sometimes by myself, as a behavioral and ecological biologist, as a weaver and a spinner and a knitter and creator of interconnection, and as a person who has been disappointed by the institutions and the people of our faith, and also held and uplifted by the institutions and the people and the faith itself. When I look at all of these things that I am and all of the experiences I've had, both and is not enough to describe it. Both and is just too small. It doesn't do enough to encourage us to go beyond the kinds of binary thinking that lend to games of winners and losers. And in the life of faith, when there are winners and losers, we all lose. So I want a frame. I want a frame that acknowledges intersectionality and focus and fluidity. I want a frame that acknowledges intersectionality, the presence and interrelatedness of many, many, many things all at once. I want focus, the understanding that those many, many things all need direct attention. And I want fluidity, the ability to notice when it is the right moment to concentrate our attention in one place and then another place when needed, while still holding to what requires our attention most. And so I see this occurring in practice now in the work of Black Lives of UU. In her essay, "Will We Repeat Our Sins?" Lena Gardner writes, "We are harnessing and tapping into the energy of a global movement for Black empowerment and using it to work not just for Black liberation, but in solidarity with many groups across a stunning array of issues for our collective liberation." She points out that even as Black Lives of UU is focused on the empowerment of Black Unitarian Universalists and Black people overall, that Black Lives of UU has also contributed an immense amount of organizer time and resources to the Revive Love Tour, put boots on the ground and contributed material donations to the No Dakota Access Pipeline Standing Rock protest encampment and the Charlotte Uprising, partnered with and sent people to the Women's March on Washington, and endorsed the Vision for Black Lives Comprehensive Policy Platform. I also recognize that this intersectionality, focus, and fluidity with members of my own parish, the Second Unitarian Church of Chicago. These folks who have been active with Black Lives Matter and the fight against police brutality, and then, when people were gathering at airports to protest the attempted travel ban of Muslims to the U.S. last January, saw no problem with heading right to the airport to protest loudly, and then come right back to keep organizing with the movement for Black lives. Often, we talk about focus through the language of centering. And centering is a good word. But when we talk about centering people or issues or ideas, and we use the image of a circle with an inside and an outside, we miss real complexity. When we say that we need to draw our circles wider and larger, we're still stuck with something that has an in and an out. We're stuck with something that has a center and a margin. We miss the truth that we exist in sprawling networks of interconnection, We marginalize people because we are formed to create and recreate a world with margins. I often wonder what would happen if we thought ecologically instead. In high school, I performed an ecological survey of a plot of land, exploring connections between animals and plants and fungi and soils and water and weather. And what became clear was how complex the system was, how many relationships existed, and how few of them I was actually able to understand. And I continued to study ecology, and it became a religious experience for me. Nature leaves me awestruck with its intricacy. Each piece of the world is intimately and necessarily connected to the others, each affecting them, changing them, supporting them in the process of living. Within it are the ideas from which we build meaning and belief, life and death, time and the seasons, the elements, the relationships, the interconnectedness of everything. So it is that ecology has given me a framework and language for going beyond both and. Many layers, many relationships, many communities and individuals, all interconnected, all intersecting in ways that we understand and ways that we don't. When one part of that system is out of balance, the whole suffers. Our theological, institutional, and social systems, our own ecosystems, are out of balance. And I believe a significant part of why we are out of balance is that we have allowed ourselves to be formed by these win-lose binaries. By our willingness to create margins and then push people to them. I believe that we need to expand our religious and liberatory imaginations, expand our vision, and then figure out how to shape ourselves to serve that expanded framework. As an example, I grew up as a Universalist in a Lutheran home. I was formed in part by parents who told me, God is love. God doesn't throw anyone away, and neither do we. We need to stop throwing people away individually and systemically. When they don't believe what we wish they did, or when they do things we don't agree with, or when they're inconvenient, or when they need to learn and aren't there yet, and especially, most especially, when they are saying important things that make us uncomfortable and aware of our failings. We need to stop throwing people away. We need to stop throwing one another away, pushing them to margins that are actually artifacts of our own malformation, our own either-or and both-and thinking. I wonder who we would become if we took our Universalist heritage seriously, if we understood it as demonstrated by ecology, showing the interconnectedness and necessity of all things. Who might we become if we chose to embody and make earthly the love of a God who would restore all people, all things to itself in love, made tangible, made just? Imagine how we might be formed if we held one another in our ecosystems, in our networks, insisting on movement toward health and justice. Recognizing that where our focus for empowerment and wholeness must be at any given moment may shift or swell or subside for a time in order to dismantle oppression. Who would we be if we truly understood that our collective existence is not binary, is not circular, but networked and intersectional? and multiple.
It is remarkable the range of things that have happened to me from the time I was asked to come here and being here and waking up the other day and asking, have I spent my life here leading people into a burning house? The same question Dr. King had to ask himself. There is no real history here of wanting to be inclusive. There is no evidence that tells me you are going to change as whites. There is no record that causes me to think I should be hopeful. Based on our record today, we are not structured to be inclusive. And we're about to, unless we do something radically different, select our first white female president to carry on what our first black and our first Latino presidents did, a dominant white faith. It won't be different, because they can't make it different. It's not in their hands. It's in ours. And it's not clear to me yet that we have made the decision to commit to be the faith we talk about as we want, saying we want to be it. I have not seen yet the kind of commitment that I had and others when I put my life on the line for my faith and my belief in the beloved community. I've not seen that here. I look back to 65 and I was attracted to this faith because white ministers were out there on the line with us saying our humanity counts, mine no more than yours. James Reed died, so some of us could be here today. Viola Luiso died, so of some, and we had a relationship with them, so we cared. We don't have a lot of relationship with poor people. We don't have a lot of relationship with people of color. And we ask the question, we keep asking the question, why aren't we more diverse? Because you haven't done the work to be diverse. The single most important factor of having someone join your faith is what? Bring a friend. Why aren't you bringing your friends? Oh, I'm sorry, you are. They don't make us more diverse. We have not done the work. And in this time, we haven't even answered the question, why must we exist? Not why should we. Why must we? Lots of folks do what we do in the religious community and other places. They don't need us. to help them find their path. So why must we exist? We are trying to find a way to build and walk a path that no one has ever walked before. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to screw it up. But guess what? If we don't walk it, it won't happen. We had the journey towards wholeness. I think of all the days and hours and the energy that many of our persons in our pews gave to this faith, saying, "I'm willing to Ross," and the ministers weren't there. The ministers didn't walk with anyone. They didn't lead anyone. They let their people try and figure it out. We're here again in a culture like we were in the 60s that's calling us to recognize humanity and our possibility of actually being a beloved community. So my question for you ministers, my colleagues, my friends, many of whom I really truly do love individually, is when you're going to get your act together? When you're going to be a collective force and live our principles to see the truth, to seek the truth, and live to be from the truth? We're at a critical point in time in this faith. We have an opportunity to do something different. When I came here this weekend, well, actually, I guess I came Monday. I was asking myself, is it worth it? And guess what? Tuesday happened. I heard the words that I've said over the years. I heard the feelings and authentic relationship of leaders who were on the stage. They were what I needed to hear. That's what we need to take into our hearts. They spoke truth. I learned some things. But what I learned most is when I looked up there, I've had a relationship with almost every one of them, a relationship with almost all of those people. And I love them. I know their lives. I know their stories. They know my story. And I found myself weeping on more than one occasion yesterday. Because when we are our best selves, when we let our emotions guide us instead of the head all the time, we become real. And that's where you connect with people. You connect through the heart. You connect through the gut. You get connected through the work together. We're not working enough together. And we're working too much within our walls, where the message we carry needs to be out in our culture. Now, I didn't have to worry yesterday. I decided I was going to experience. So I kind of went up to the balcony and I said, I'm going to just watch going on because I don't need a job. And I'm retired. I retired to do real work where we do transformative change, not talk about it. And you don't need more of people's time to play games. We do transactional change, dealing with personnel and policies and practices. That's BS. Transformative change calls us to deal with our purpose and our structures and to measure what we do and how we do it along the way, to feed us data to help us correct it and make it more humane. If you aren't doing that, we're not much needed. We do have a message, but people pay attention more to how you live your life. One of my great life lessons was my daughter, Melanie, heard me saying to her some things about how she ought to behave and what she ought to do and, you know, why she didn't do this and that. And she just very simply looked at me and said, "Dad, I can't hear your words because your actions speak so loudly." That was one of the best pieces of feedback I ever got in my life. And I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the fact that I have a beautiful, almost 2-year-old grandchild. She's about the same age when I came back into Unitarian Universalism when she was 2. And she found some connection here, as did our boys, and it made a difference in their lives. But I'm not sure now. My boys, my oldest son and his wife spent 10 years looking to find a UU congregation in their areas, and they would say, "Dad and Mom, they don't do church like you do." They finally settled on a UCC church, which is more UU than I know most of our churches to be. My daughter and her husband, she surprised me the other day. She says, "Dad, I've been visiting a couple of the UU churches because I want to think about Brighton. Can I trust her with Unitarian Universalism?" So I came. If you're not going to get your act together, quit acting like it and quit playing. Tell folks what you're going to be so they can make a real choice. If you're going to be it, and the old expression of the street, get off the pot of shit. We don't have time for playing, and we don't need allies, we need partners. We need people who are going to be anti-racist and they're going to live their lives from it. And guess what? The faith may be shorter and it may be not as many members. It'll be so much more powerful and meaningful. Thank you.
Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. For your people are my people. Your people are mine. Your people are my people. Your divine, my divine. Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. For your people are my people. Your people are mine. Your people are my people. Your divine, my divine. Where you go, I will go. People are mine. Your When Unitarian Universalism found me one Easter morning, I didn't know I was looking for it, but as soon as it appeared, I recognized a hunger I had been subconsciously trying to feed. I rejoiced in realizing I may have stumbled into a holy place that professed to welcome all of me, tal como soy. Months later, when I found Unitarian Universalism, I jumped for joy. I smiled a great big grin across that hunger hole, danced in the aisle, felt the sun's rays come right through the ceiling, illuminating a circular warmth just around me, having discovered a thing I hadn't known existed. Between us, though, I did not feel I am home. I had a home filled with the treasures of my culture, the spirited hospitality, the community comes firstness, the love sung to us that permeates every generation. Even with that initial holy reaction, I had not run toward this thing. When I finally took another peek, I understood that I had been searching. Something had been resurrected in me. The stone had been rolled away from the dark and dank room of spiritual isolation. In time, taking that leap of faith into community that such encounters demand, the you and you of it all whispered that I was a valued human being, said aloud that I was wanted, bellowed that I was needed and might eventually be loved. It was believed as it was uttered to me. I believed it as I heard it. It seemed at the time a good fit, but I never imagined this sacred theology could get so distorted. Ultimately, to me and those of my siblings of color, the words came to mean painful, spirit-crushing lies. At least that was how the you and the you was lived out in our presence, where we learned that not all of us were accepted. Some were too much, others not enough, even as we were offered marginal platforms to teach the Pale Center. As a form of survival and a strategy to belong, we learned to perpetuate the lies. I kept lying to myself, to you, and most painfully, to my daughter, hoping that one glorious sun streaking down through the clouds day, our life-affirming gospel would be true for each and every one of us. Para mi gente, the Latino and now Latinx, yes, but also for all who we say are our people, our trans, gender queer, and nonconforming siblings, our bisexuals and those in constellations, our siblings of African heritage and Black folk, our not hiding in plain sight but treated as such beloved scooterati, our even more invisibilized Native cousins and Asian and Pacific Islanders, the Roma who spoke today. This poem could be just about naming people whose names are not spoken and whose faces are not seen, as the too often not intending to but show up as immoral majority look past us or over us. Beloved, if you find yourself in these words, hay esperanza. Like you, I am thoroughly exhausted. Yet living this unity brings no salvation. The center of our being has just been too pale, beyond what is healthy. This thing we found, made so long ago for freedom, was not made free. And now, to look freer, hip and mod, questions are asked of us. How do we add some cocoa, and what kind are acceptable? How do we add un poquito de hot salsa? Do we say powwow or native gathering, handicapped or person in a wheelchair, Asian or Oriental? Please tell me. Code for, can we still do their work for them? I ask for us, do you want us here? Do you want to be free? Actually, the questions are no longer relevant, but we are. The pale center needs us to remain relevant, whether they recognize it or not. We understand that the answers linger around the edges, and the center must face out to see that we are no longer trying to step carefully in. It's stomping time now. We humans of color have always reached for something more, exercising and building up quite a resilient muscle that is necessary against the many gatekeepers still trying to deter us. Being resilient in the face of dissenting voices is a gift that we bring. In the fight to be an anti-racist, anti-oppressive, multicultural, faithful religion, we know, heartbreakingly so, that some sitting in this room have locked the gate from the inside and have sent some of our brightest stars away, telling us we are not worth saving. Our faith challenged to our very cores, we mourn that loss every day. As a Latina in this painful and momentous moment of our movement, it is not easy to confront our faith's flaws, especially when our Latinx history is ignored and microaggressions pile up alongside tokenization. Still, many of us have chosen not to roll, walk, or limp away. Despite the pain we live with to stay in, despite our pale center's penchant for making false promises toward real freedom and bleeding out what is already vital, we need to change this pattern. I fear we are reliving our past by separating out our colors in a hierarchy of importance. And I say this today because I know others in our impacted casa are afraid to say this out loud. I know that for decades, Latinx and other people of color have been afraid to speak their truth, have been afraid to demand actions that are beyond the binary code, have been afraid to ask, why is it that we haven't organized together? I was one, and I risk saying it now because I love you. Yes. I love us. And where you go, beloveds, is where I want to go together. Even as I struggle with where my loyalties lie and the reality that I am pushed to decide which ancestral lines to lift up in a supremacist society that survives by having us believe that we have to choose and that it is a choice, when we listen to the call of something more, let us create a unity that does not lower us to the merest common denominator, knowing that dealing with our complexity forces everyone of all colors to look at ourselves deeply. Let us band together as indigenous and people of color to be the shift that knocks the you and the you off the linear route it's been engaged in. For in 50 years, all of the self-centeredness has not led to a tipping point of self-awareness. Let us beseech. Is it really too much for our pale siblings to acknowledge their privilege and do the work to dismantle every ounce of supremacy that dominates all of us? We are focused on who gets to be in the center instead of strengthening our own centers. Our individual cores are on fire, but one chaliced flame they do not make. If the pale center responds to the call for something more, they will turn and face the edges where we are, a rainbow of faces and cultures engaging in a Unitarian Universalism that breathes love into its very core from our well-worn hearts. They will find us no longer waiting, but creating a Unitarian Universalism of our own for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. To Ashley, Kristen, Adam, Mill, and Marta for your great acts of witness and service. We are prophetic in more than one way, and one of the ways we're prophetic is we knew there would not be much time for questions. And I'm going to say this. I believe that there is really no time for questions, that enough has been said. And I will once again ask us, before the scribe has asked me to close this part of our program in prayer, which I will do in a moment, but before I do that, I'd ask us one more time just to take a moment to thank those brave colleagues who have asked us into this deeper conversation. Thank you. And because we are a people of faith, I invite us into the spirit of reflection, meditation, and prayer. Spirit of life, God of love and unity, inestimable mystery of the more. We are before you today with gratitude first. Gratitude for the opportunity to always deepen and discern the way of our living tradition in new and challenging times. We are grateful for the truth that howled louder than the winds outside. We are grateful that our faith compels us to build heaven within this earth, in this one flawed and precious world that we know we are given. Our prayer, our deep ask beyond our knowing today, our ask that reaches beyond our abilities to the realm of the holy and sacred, is that we know ourselves to be called always and ever into deeper and deeper relationship. That we have the fortitude to make again and again the daily choices of deepened commitment, that engagement be our binding work of spirit, that we be tireless in our efforts to embody our life-giving tradition, to embody our life-giving tradition in a newly centered plane of inclusiveness. We ask that we be brave enough to cast off that which no longer serves us. Doctrines and practices of supremacy, dysfunctional denials of our own power. We ask that we witness our own truths and receive the truths of others as sacrament. We ask that we finally, most importantly, cradle these truths together until new and essential truths are born among us. And in this way, may we be faithful stewards, skillful midwives, architects of the scaffolding for a beloved community we will never see in our lifetime, and yet which we must always build towards. May we transform, forgive, form, and reform preference relationship, and be and live our theology. And may we, today, each one of us, be the ones to make it so. Amen and blessed be.
On behalf of the Executive Committee of the Conference at Berry Street, thank you. You have held our tradition into a new light. As we close, I want to thank Barbara Queeman for her service on the Executive Committee, and in her place, the UUMA Board has appointed Lindy Ramsden. Thank you, Lindy. Mm-hmm. I know what you want. I am pleased to announce next year's essayist for the 198th conference is Meg Riley. I now call the 197th Ministerial Conference in Bay Street out of session. Godspeed.